Welcome back to Background Briefing. This is Jessica Levinson filling in for Ian Masters. Joining us for our last segment is Tori Van Oot. She's a reporter for the Sacramento Bee. She also blogs for the newspaper's website, thesacbee.com. She's covered campaigns, ethics and campaign law issues, political party conventions, the state senate, and the state budget. A little bit of everything. Ms. Van Oot, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to dive right in by talking about two changes to California's electoral system that we've just seen play out in the last elections. Redistricting for the first time in the state's history, an independent redistricting commission drew the state and federal legislative lines. And we also have a new open primary top-two election system whereby any voter can vote for any candidate regardless of party affiliation in the primary, and then the top two vote-getters, regardless of party affiliation, proceed to the general election. And from your unique vantage point, covering this from the state's capital, could you tell us how these reforms have played out in the most recent elections?
I think the two biggest takeaways were competition and turnover. And you saw both of those increase both at the state legislative and the congressional level. In terms of turnover, that's kind of something that naturally goes along with redistricting. You've got new lines. This year, as you said, the independent commission drew those lines, so they weren't necessarily thinking about where incumbents, where sitting members already lived. So you had some situations where two members of Congress were in the same district and had to run against one another, or a member that was older, a more senior member, seeing, oh, wow, I've got a really competitive seat for the first time in years, I'm going to step down, creating kind of a free-for-all for that seat. So in that respect, you had a lot more turnover than in the past in our congressional delegation. And in the legislature, it was just massive. I believe 37 members of the state assembly are going to be freshmen, are new to the Capitol. That's almost half of the 80-member body. In terms of competition, that redistricting also did create more competition. The top two primary, one of the effects of that is that we had 28 races where two members of the same party were running on the general election ballot, so two Democrats or two Republicans. In those races, one-third of those races were decided by a margin of 10% or less. So they were very competitive in the races with a Democrat versus a Republican. The more traditional races, the percentage of races determined by that small of a margin more than doubled. So we saw a huge amount of competition in this year's elections.
So that sounds like a significant amount of change. And what I sometimes see as a synonym to competition is expense. And that brings us to another topic that I wanted to talk to you about, which is campaign finance. Competitive races tend to be the most expensive races. This was the most expensive election in our nation's history. The first elections that really took place after Citizens United and the first elections after the rise of super PACs. Could you tell us, based on your reporting, how those developments have changed the elections in California and beyond?
It was a hugely expensive race on the state and congressional levels in California. Fundraising for state legislative and congressional candidates was up as a result, as you said, likely of those more competitive races. And the outside spending was very, very large. You know, on the state level, we have independent expenditures, which, like super PACs, can raise and spend unlimited amounts. 1 week out before the election, spending on state legislative races had exceeded $20 million. And then that number is just expected to rise as the final spending reports trickle in. The number of competitive congressional races in Sacramento alone was home to one of the most expensive races. There was more than, I think it was $8 million spent in the race between Ami Bera, the Democrat who won against incumbent Republican Dan Lundgren. And that $8 million was from outside groups independent of the campaigns, you know, super PACs on both sides of the aisle. And it resulted in voters getting a lot of mostly negative advertising, just bombarded them this cycle. The airwaves in Sacramento, where there were four contested congressional races, you couldn't watch a commercial break without seeing three, four campaign ads all crammed in. So, you know, voters, I think, certainly felt the effects of all of that spending.
Well, I want to talk about something you just brought up, which is that people were kind of bombarded by spending and electioneering communications. And one of the other developments we saw, of course, in this election is the rise of so-called dark money, undisclosed sums that were spent in our campaigns. And I'm wondering how these sums change the way you cover campaigns.
It definitely makes it more difficult. The biggest example, I guess, from this past election was an $11 million contribution made to a committee that wasn't for a certain candidate, but for Proposition 32, a ballot measure that affected unions, a campaign finance measure that affected unions' abilities to raise money for political purposes, and against Prop 30, Governor Brown's initiative. And I'm sure you've talked about this with Chairwoman Ravel in the show earlier, but, you know, as reporters, we have no way to tell our readers or our viewers, if you're on TV or your listeners on the radio, who's behind this message and who's putting a message on the air or who's putting a message in your inboxes can tell you as a voter or as a resident a lot about why they might be saying that, why they might be attacking that candidate, or why they might be supporting the other candidate. So it just makes it more difficult to provide that sort of context and information for our readers.
Well, do you see that changing anytime soon? I know that after Citizens United, there was a good deal of chatter about a Disclose Act. Does it seem like real reform is happening on the state level?
You know, there was some momentum behind a Disclose Act on the state level this past year. I've heard other chatter about initiative potentially targeting some of this spending coming in down the pipeline in the next for the next election. And I think we'll just see what the sort of political interest in that or by lawmakers or by other interests that might put that on the ballot would be. You know, I know that for voters, you know, I think super PACs already become kind of a dirty word. So there's a bit of a backlash maybe if you're someone like this nonprofit from Arizona who decided to write that $11 million check. You then have the governor, Jerry Brown, going up and down the state talking about the money, the people behind the mask who won't come out, the shadowy money, and you know, it might have had a little bit of a backlash for that campaign that they were trying to help with that money.
Well, I think
that could be a result as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. We could see reform via legislation or via public backlash and kind of outcry against certain sums being spent. You mentioned that this money was spent for against ballot measures, and I want to talk briefly about the ballot initiative process because it's hard to overstate its importance, as you know, in California. This last November, we weighed in on no less than 11 ballot initiatives. As you've recently written about, some are already being challenged in court. From your perspective, how does the initiative process affect politics in California?
Well, it definitely has a big impact. I mean, if you have a couple of million dollars at your disposal, you can put a sort of policy on the ballot in front of voters. You can pay someone to gather the signatures and you can place it on. And one thing we saw this year was several of those measures were had already been proposed through the legislature and had failed to make it through the legislature. One example was within an initiative on cracking down on human trafficking. There is a provision, this is one of the ones that's being challenged actually, that has to do with registered sex offenders telling law enforcement about their online identities, their email addresses, their social media accounts, that sort of thing. That proposal failed in the legislature, but through the initiative process, it was they were able to get it on. The supporters were able to get it on the ballot. So it creates a really interesting dynamic where you have different interests pushing for changes or policies through the legislature, and if that might not work, they can go directly to the people. And that's often a very costly option, but it's one that people do choose to pursue.
Well, and as you know, I have an op-ed in your newspaper, the SACBee, where I can call for reforms to the initiative process for some of the reasons that you mentioned. It's become very expensive. It's become kind of a shadow government. Do you see any, same question I asked really about disclosure. Is there chatter about really reforming the initiative process? Does it look like it's here to stay in its current form?
I think it's something that would be difficult to do, but it seems like there is some political will for that. Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, the top Senate Democrat, has said even before this election that one of the things he wanted to do in the coming term was propose some changes to the initiative process that includes some sort of sunset for initiatives. One of the criticisms of the process that especially resonates around the Capitol is an initiative that, for example, creates some sort of spending requirement or a funding formula. That's locked in, and the legislature typically can't change that or get around that. So it can create some costs or budget constraints for the state. So Senator Steinberg wants to do a variety of things. He hasn't put it in paper yet in a bill form. It's a little early for that. But things like having a sunset, some sort of, I believe he talked about legislative review or option where if you're proposing an initiative, the legislature had a little bit of a window to tackle that issue first, is something else that's been in talks. So we'll see what happens. There's been other reform proposals as well. I think in one kind of blue ribbon task force had some proposed changes to the initiative process that they could try to put on the ballot separately. Senator Steinberg has a supermajority now in the upper house that he could use to put some of those measures on the ballot in front of the people if he has some reforms that he wants to put to paper.
Well, I know you're going to be covering this closely, and I'll be following you. And one of the things I want to wrap up with in our remaining time together is how people follow you and how this has changed campaigns. It seems to me that you're constantly blogging on SACBee.com. You're tweeting on Capitol Alert. How has social media changed the business of covering campaigns?
It makes us have a lot more deadlines.
Right.
Every deadline is 5 minutes ago. As you mentioned, we have our blog. It's SACBee/Capitol Alert. It's the Capitol Alert blog. We do at least 2 email blasts a day, and I tweet probably dozens of times a day. And it's a really interesting thing. There's a demand to get the news out first, but from a reporter's perspective, we also want to be accurate. We want to have context, and we want to make sure that everything we're reporting is a legitimate story, is worthy of the platform we're putting it on. So it's not just, so we don't become just a kind of transcription service rebroadcasting everything that campaigns or candidates or politicians put out in our email inboxes. The thing that I really like about the social media is the engagement. We interact a lot more with sources, with followers, with just political junkies. People are asking us questions during the day, and sometimes it's a question that leads to a really good story. And sometimes people have insights or other tips that we can pick up through that. It's made news gathering and reporting much more of a conversation. A very loud, sometimes disjointed conversation, but a conversation nonetheless.
Well, Ms. Fanute, I know I always enjoy interacting with you on social media and otherwise. I want to thank you very much for joining us and bringing your perspective. It was very helpful for the listeners. So thank you
Great.
Again.
Well, thanks for having me.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, filling in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. This show is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can find my blogs at paullawtics.lls.edu or follow me on Twitter at LevinsonJessica. Background Briefing will be back tomorrow with more interesting guest hosts for the rest of the week. Bye for now.
Disappeared by half.